I first met Richard Flanagan in 1999 in Tasmania. Richard at that stage was a novelist with an international reputation. And that evening he told me a story, and it was the story behind one of his very first books. Richard had written this book, or rather he'd ghost-written it, in the very early 90s. This was a time when he and his young family were scratching around for a living in Hobart. The book was supposed to be the memoir of Australia's biggest ever con man, a man named John Friedrich. The story, as Richard told it to me that night, was very funny and mad and incoherent. And I thought of it as just one of those incredibly bizarre things that happen in life that's hard to make sense of. John Friedrich is almost a forgotten figure today. But for a brief while, Friedrich dominated the news in Australia for weeks on end. And that's because his con was of staggering proportions. In the 1980s, John Friedrich managed to get himself appointed as the head of the Victorian division of the National Safety Council of Australia. Friedrich then expanded the council. He transformed it from a low-key safety awareness organisation into a high-tech paramilitary-style search and rescue operation with an air fleet, a 42-metre ocean-going vessel, and a mini-submarine for deep-sea rescues. Yes, it was the Thunderbirds, and every bit as far-fetched. But John Friedrich, at the time, wasn't an Australian citizen. He wasn't even John Friedrich. He was a foreign fugitive from justice who'd been living in Australia under a false name. Richard Flanagan's new novel has drawn on his experience as John Friedrich's ghostwriter, and the story's taken on a darkly comic shape. The novel is called First Person, and it tells the story of struggling writer Kif Kelman, who's got 6 weeks to ghostwrite the memoir of the con artist, Ziggy Heidel, for which he'll receive a desperately needed paycheck. But soon, the ghostwriter begins to fear that the con man is changing him, that his black worldview is seeping into him. I spoke with Richard Flanagan at a special event at the Brisbane Powerhouse. First of all, Richard, can you tell us how John Friedrich came into your life?
Well, John Friedrich rang me one night in 1991, a wintry night. I was working as a labourer, trying to write my first novel and failing. My wife, Maida, was heavily pregnant with twins and things were going very badly when the phone rang and I picked it up and it was Australia's Most Wanted on the other end. Now, what had happened to John Friedrich was the National Safety Council collapsed. It was front page news. Curious things began to come out, such as the fact that although he had an Order of Australia and been photographed with just about every politician in the country, he didn't actually have an Australian passport. There was large questions whether John Friedrich was even John Friedrich. He went on the run. There was the biggest manhunt in Australian history, and they finally found him in Monkey Mere in West Australia, arrested him, extradited him back to Melbourne. And he'd been in the watch house for about an hour when the phone rang, and it was Harry M. Miller. And Harry, the well-known celebrity agent, Harry said, "Don't sign anything, I'll cut the deal." And the deal Harry cut for John Friedrich was a very lucrative publishing contract for his memoir. Friedrich got out on bail, a year and a half went by, and of course, being criminally indisposed to putting anything on paper, the publishers received no memoir. So then they put him to work with editors and their own ghostwriters, all of whom gave up within half a day because he could be an abhorrent individual. And so they then said it was getting very close to trial. He had 6 weeks before he's to go to trial and he was going to go down for a very long time. And they said, if you won't work with our people, you find a writer who you can work with. Well, John Friedrich didn't know any writers, but his bodyguard, a Tasmanian, said, "I've got a mate in Tasmania who wants to be a writer." Thus is a literary career born. And I received this phone call, and John Friedrich offered me $10,000 if I would ghostwrite his memoirs in 6 weeks. You don't have to know a lot about writing to recognise how ludicrous the whole proposal was. But it wasn't that concerned me. Being a young man of some vanity and pretension, I was worried about my literary reputation for at least 5 minutes until I realised, not having written any novel, I didn't actually have a literary reputation to worry about. So I said yes, and I flew to Melbourne the next day, and I met a very unprepossessing short man in a strange disguise. He had this funny little beard and glasses. He looked a bit like Yasser Arafat off to a fancy dress ball. And he was a man of secrets, and we were to work in this publisher's office. And the first secret he made me keep was that we would tell no one that we were ghostwriting his memoir. We were to say we were editing an anthology of German medieval folk verse. I must have been the only person in the publishing house who believed that anyone would believe such a ludicrous lie. But that's what I had to say in the canteen. And so 3 weeks went by in which he told me nothing about himself and evaded every question I asked. And then he shot himself dead. Then he was once more front page news, and the publisher did what publishers do and was everywhere in the news saying he had a tell-all memoir that would answer the now many perplexing questions about John Friedrich, who wasn't John Friedrich. But he wouldn't divulge any details, as well he wouldn't, because I was sitting in a Hobart pub trying to make them up. And it's said of most writers' first novels, the criticism is that they're autobiographical, but in my case, my first autobiography was rapidly degenerating into a novel. And I finished it 3 weeks later. It's not much of a book, I have to be honest. It was published to instant oblivion. There was what I felt a slightly odious and unfair campaign by an organisation called Don't Buy Books from Crooks, which in other circumstances I may have found offensive. But I got the $10,000, which was good if, as Woody Allen once said, only for financial reasons. And and with that, I was able to stop labouring and finish what became my first novel, Death of a River God.
I want to go right back to the start of this. I'm sorry, you just glossed over a whole bunch of stuff there. So it was his bodyguard that reached across the Tasman to you, working as a builder's labourer, to bring over to Melbourne to ghostwrite this book. What was your mate doing for Friedrich at the time?
Well, my mate had been, he'd worked at the National Safety Council as a parachute jumper, as you said in your... he was actually... They did extraordinary things to no apparent rational purpose. So my mate was the first man in Australia to leap out of a plane with a parachute and an Alsatian strapped to him.
Do you know if the Alsatian was facing him at the time? So how were things going for you and your family when you got that call? And what did $10,000 mean to you at that time?
We were completely broke, and you know, things were very hard for us. We had a daughter who was 3. Because Maida was heavily pregnant with twins, she'd stopped working, and I was pursuing this cracked vanity of wanting to be a novelist. I didn't know anybody in publishing. I knew nothing about the world of books. And it wasn't that I had a plan B in case it went wrong. I didn't even have a plan A. I didn't know how to get the book published or how I'd make a living as a writer. So the prospect of actually being able to make some money quickly was infinitely attractive.
What did your mate tell you about Friedrich? Did he warn you about him?
Yeah, my mate gave me very good advice about him. He warned me not to let him into my life in any way, to not tell him anything about my family, my friends, not to give him one personal detail. When he called home, never let Maida talk to him, because once he knew some things about you, he would begin using them against you. He had an extraordinary power over some people. And in the 3 weeks I spent with him, although he told me very little in the way of the truth about himself, I did learn some things about him. And he frightened me in a way I'd never been frightened before. He had a capacity to possess some people. And I saw it with some of the people who came into the room who were various associates of his. And he had a coherent philosophy of evil.
What do you mean?
He believed that the world was evil, and he believed that you could accept this and take what rewards accrue along the way in the knowledge you'd still be destroyed by that evil, but at least you got some rewards and some pleasures. Or you could be a fool and pretend it wasn't evil. You would get no rewards or joys, and you would still be destroyed by it. And he didn't say this in the manner of a proselytizer. He wasn't out to convert me to his opinion. He just felt that the evidence of the world was very clear on this.
And people who, like yourself, or I suppose like most people, who don't see the world that way, did he think you were a hypocrite or something, or just very foolish if you didn't have that jewel-like clarity of his view of the world as an evil place?
He just thought I was a naive fool. But I think I had the arrogance of thinking that I had some superiority to him because he was a criminal, because he was, you know, he'd lost. He was, he'd been found out. But I quickly became disabused of that. I could see that he had understandings of life and the world that I didn't, and an experience of it that I didn't. And I didn't have answers for his arguments. And I guess I came to be haunted by the memory of that. He also, he postured, but he postured about things that disturbed me. He talked about having people killed. And, you know, this seemed to me for a while to be puffery. But then you realise it's a thin line with a posturer when they decide to act on their posture because it enhances their standing. So you never knew who he really was, but he invited you to enter enter this darkness. And my problem was I had to try and tease things out of him. I had to engage with him. So I had to stand every day on the edge of the abyss, but make sure I didn't topple in. So it was a difficult game I was playing. And I was staying at my brother's place. I really knew nothing. I rang the publisher to find out what the deal was, and I thought I should ask for expenses. And I added up what a pie had cost and tram fares, and I said I needed $13 a day. He snorted. He snorted with laughter, and I don't know why I mentioned that, actually. Anyway,
$13 a day, but if pushed, you'd go down to 12 or 11.50, perhaps.
But I was staying with my brother, sleeping on his floor, my brother Martin, and each night I used to stand under the shower and run the hot water out, trying to wash him off me. And it was a couple of nights before I realised what I was doing.
See, people like that have long personally fascinated me and horrified me. And that idea that the world is a veil of tears, it's a big, big theatre of cruelty, is something that is shared by Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin in particular. He had a nice little line of black humour about the world, and Saddam Hussein. They conclude that the world's a terrible, terrible place, and they're genius, and they see it as a kind of a genius, is that they perceive the truth of this, and everyone else is a hypocrite or a fool. And it's long been a thing I've been frightened of, is to be in the thrall or at the mercy of such a person, to live in a society governed by that person or personally in that orbit. Had you ever given much thought to those kinds of people who are really psychopaths, just that operate on a very large scale?
Well, I mean, I grew up in an era where the wisdom was, and it was very widely accepted, that things are the product of environment. That there really isn't evil, that it's the consequence of bad upbringing or, it's a chemical imbalance, or there's reasons. And then you meet a man who frightens you, who feels evil, and who doesn't seem to answer to any understanding that you've been given as part of your education. And so it was so shocking that I had no answer to it, none at all. I just had to deal with it each day. And then, of course, he shot himself dead.
There's the kind of more banal sort of aspect of the world that you're dealing with, which is the way you write about the publishing industry in the early 1990s. And the character who's the publisher is a man named Gene Paley. He's a wonderful character. Like, there's a moment when he disrobes in front of the author, Kiff Kelman. He just takes his shirt off, exposes his unpleasant body to him. What's going on there? Is there a kind of contempt in that, in him, for the author?
Oh, well, it interests me how people with power manifest their power, and it's a common thing for them. You know, kings who used to sit on the privy and demand their courtiers come and attend to them, attend to matters of state while they're having a shit. And
Lyndon Johnson did that.
Lyndon Johnson did it. Bob Hawke used to have people in when he was having a bath, and, you know, and it's making very clear what the relationship of power is. And you get it in every sphere of life, you know, and it's a horrifying thing when you meet it, because it is a form of contempt for you as a human being.
For the writer, it's kind of interesting from a publisher. I'd love you to read a passage early on in the book. It's very early on, where you talk about Gene Paley, the author, and his attitude towards novels and literature, please.
It was whispered around the publishing house that Gene Paley was frightened of literature, and not without good reason. For one thing, it doesn't sell. For another, it can fairly be said that it asks questions that it can't answer. It astonishes people with themselves, which, on balance, is rarely a good thing. It reminds them that the business of life is failure, and that the failure to know this is true ignorance. Maybe there is transcendence in all this, or wisdom in some of it, but Gene Paley didn't see himself in the transcendence game. Gene Paley was all for books telling you one or two things over and over, but preferably only one. Selling, Gene Paley would say, is telling.
This book is set in the very early 90s, at the moment when interest rates have crept up and up and up and up, and the economy's just about to crack, and we're about to be plunged into the worst recession in Australia since the Great Depression. I remember this time really well. Do you see in that moment in the early 90s the origin of some ideas that were to go on to become very, very powerful in the world?
Well, I do. I think what was being born there were several ideas which were sort of shocking then, but which are widely accepted now. And I was quite haunted by John Friedrich, but in his dark visions, in his narcissism, in his sense that, in his capacity to deny truth with ever grander lies, and in the way in which the more implausible the lie he created, the more people wished to believe it, he seemed to anticipate the whole strangeness of the next few decades. And it took me a long time to understand what had happened to me and who he was. I couldn't make sense of it for many, many years. But I think several things have happened in recent times that help clarify my thoughts on this. The first is that we've seen an extraordinary attack on the notion of people's private lives. Mark Zuckerberg said privacy is no longer an acceptable social norm. And he went on to talk about how people will no longer have an identity at work, an identity in their private life. What social media will do is grant them the integrity of only one identity, their online identity. But Gabriel Garcia Marquez said, everyone has a public life, a private life, and a secret life. And I think that private life and secret life are very important to us. And it is because contained within them is the many strange aspects of our soul that are not reducible to one identity. And novels particularly are something we go to because they remind us that implicit in each of us is a universe of possibilities, some better, some worse, all love, all hate, the murderer, the lover, and so on. And I think reading in this age when privacy is so under attack, reading remains a deeply private act. And I think it's become, in a strange way, a subversive act. And books have become a new counterculture. And if you think this sounds a little hyperbolic and overstated, I'd invite you to ponder the case of the American actress Shailene Woodley, the star of Big Little Lies, who a few weeks ago was walking the red carpet at the Emmys, and she was asked, what TV shows are you watching? And she gave what I thought was an entirely innocent reply, that she didn't have a television because she preferred to read books. And she was condemned across the media for this. And I thought, this is very new when books, when there's such hostility towards books. And I think what you get with social media now is this desire, or we're persuaded now, each of us, to be our own big brother, to report daily, hourly, and even more frequently on ourselves. And in that world of social media, everybody's encouraged to be their own first person, to be the hero of their own lives. But what's happening is it's being used simply to be monetized, as the new word goes, by corporations, or to be surveilled by the state. And I felt, in a way, this was what Friedrich had been doing all those years ago, creating a world in which he was first person, in his narcissism, in his solipsism. And so I thought a novel was the place to begin to try and understand some of these things. Because a novel, and this is the second aspect that I've grown, that I saw more and more reflected in the present times from my experience of John Friedrich, and that is that truths come under attack. It's not when people lie that they're simply, people have always lied in public life, but now the lies have a new purpose, and the purpose is to deny the very concept of the truth. We're seeing the idea of an objective truth being daily corroded. And if in the end there is no objective truth and there's only opinion, then the most powerful will tell us what the world is and we'll have to agree with it, because we'll no longer have the power to say what it really is. So you've got people like Maurice Newman, Tony Abbott's former advisor, saying recently that the Bureau of Meteorology has been fabricating its temperature records. Now, if it's not an objective truth that today was 28 degrees Celsius, if you can't believe that, then we're only left with opinion. And you have that world that Karl Rove, George Bush's Svengali, described back in 2004, when he said, we're the empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality, and you will follow that reality. And that's power saying, we will tell you what the world is, and you will have to accept it. And that, to me, is very frightening. And it's said now that reality has outstripped fiction, and that fiction can't deal with this new reality. But it's not so. It's untruth that has outstripped truth. And more than ever, we need to rediscover what the truth is. We need to honour it. And I genuinely believe in the novel as one of the great spiritual and intellectual and aesthetic traditions. And at its best, it speaks to fundamental truths about the human condition. It's not that it has answers, but at its best, it asks the necessary questions we need to ask of ourselves and of our times.
This is Conversations on ABC Radio.
I can recall the first time I met you was in 1999, and you told me this story about you and Friedrich. And I think at the time, the way I remember you telling me, it was funny and blackly comic. It was almost like a bit of gonzo journalism. It seemed kind of mad and formless. And now it's coherent and it has a shape to it and these larger ideas that come to it. Have you been waiting all this time, in a way, for it to have this coherence, for it to suit the times in which you've written this book?
Well, the first thing I'd say is a novel without structure is a jellyfish pretending to be a white pointer. So life can be chaos, but a novel has to have structure. But my thoughts were incoherent on it, and it was an incoherent part of my life. And what I did with the novel was I invented completely different characters and destinies for all the people involved. So I took those elements of my own life, meeting John Friedrich and so on, but then I invented a story to try and look at all these questions that had haunted me ever since I met him. But you're right, it did take many, many years. What gave me a clarity about it was the great changes that took place in our world, and the way this new world coming into being was greased by this strange solipsism that encouraged everybody to find the answer not within society or community, but within themselves. And that took every form of madness from Vikram yoga to paleo diets. Perhaps the answer is that, or whatever the answer is, it exists in others, you know, and that's what the book drives at.
I watched a little bit of footage of Friedrich being interviewed, and he has that weird baby face blandness to him, like you say. But when he's talking and he's animated, he seems quite boyish and enthusiastic and really benign. How much support was he able to glean from the great and the good in Australia?
Oh, they loved him. Everybody endorsed him. You know, from Kim Beazley on, everybody wanted to be photographed with him. Everybody wanted to speak highly of him. Because not his least gift as a con man was that he rarely lied. He invited other people to invent the great deceits. And so he played on their desire to be seen with this Thunderbirds-type organisation. He played on their desire to be associated with an organisation that never quite made sense but seemed to have connections with the CIA, that seemed to have strange counter-surveillance capacities that were in demand around the world.
What kind of plans did he have for Australia to enter the space race?
That was later. That was after he'd been released on bail and he got another scam up.
He's been exposed as a con man in the national media?
Yes. It was actually debated in the Queensland Parliament. He got the Queensland government somehow to deny that they were backing John Friedrich to find a new site for a space station in Cape York. But once they denied it, of course, everyone believed it. and the whole thing became plausible. But he was merely fleecing another poor group of individuals and just riding around in a helicopter in Cape York with my mate, the bodyguard.
Tell me about the trick he performed with shipping containers, please.
The basis of his con, that he got the $300 million out of the banks, about $1 billion in today's terms, was to invite the bankers to come to his training facilities, and he'd get the 400 parachute jumpers to march past in their car keys and so on. And then he'd take them through this shipping container. And the way he sold the organisation was that when there was an oil well blew up, or when there was a hostage crisis, or when there was whatever happened, they would fly in some of these shipping containers and they'd become the operational centre. And the shipping containers had all this state-of-the-art, high-tech equipment in them, and you would, however many shipping containers you'd need, they'd transport them. And he'd show them through the shipping container, which apparently was very space-agey, and they'd be infinitely impressed. And then he'd put them in Idi Amin's helicopter, which he had.
Idi Amin's helicopter?
He had Idi Amin's helicopter, and he'd had my mate shoot it up, so that he claimed it was the helicopter that tried to assassinate Idi Amin in. And then the helicopter would rise with the bankers in it, and they'd bank over this sporting ground, which had hundreds and hundreds of containers stacked up like Singapore Harbour. And And then, of course, the bankers just thought this was extraordinary. What they didn't know was that every one of them was empty. They weren't even real shipping containers. He had a Croatian knocking them up down in Geelong. But really, when you think about it, the whole world was about to be deceived by a similar scam. But the shipping containers were going to be called Bear Stearns and Enron. They were going to be called trickle-down economics, rising tide lifts all boats, neoliberalism. And at the end, they too would be revealed as the same rusting, empty holes. And the whole system that we'd been led to believe we're all going to prosper in was revealed as the same scam, but on a monstrous and gargantuan scale.
The argument at the time was that market economics would be a force for truth. It would scour away sentimentality around enterprises, objects, and reveal the true underlying dollar value behind them.
Well, the problem with it is that it assumes ultimately the markets can be a moral force. And I think the markets are subject to moral laws, but they're greed and panic and fear. And so that if you allow the markets to have unfettered reign over your society, you've actually delivered it to the worst aspects of human nature. And that was, I think, the great mistake that was made. The second thing I think that arises from that is that it was assumed in the West, particularly after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, that freedom and progress would continue to grow stronger together, because that had more or less been the history of the West. And this was so taken for granted that no one stopped to think that perhaps the two aren't inevitably joined together. And you've only got to look at the example of China to see the terrible truth that you can have progress without freedom. But there is an enormous void that arises, and in that void is a terrible darkness. And I think the rickety hinge that holds freedom and progress together is truth, because that's the only thing we have to test whether power is being abused, whether the price of progress is at the expense of our lives, and so on. And once you are living in a world where the truth no longer has meaning, then we've come to a very dangerous pass. That was the lesson I learnt from Friedrich all those years ago.
What did he tell you on the last day you spent with him?
Well, he was very disturbed. He claimed people were trying to kill him, the banks or the CIA. He had terrible bruising around his neck, and he claimed two would-be murderers had tried to jump him and strangle him the night before. And I felt all this was just another melodramatic diversion. And I was under great pressure to get the book finished. I now had a manuscript that I needed him to sign off on, and he was refusing to do even that. And so we ended up having a confrontation where we shoved each other around a bit. And then his coat fell open and he actually had a gun. He was carrying a gun by then. I stepped back and he realised he'd frightened me. Because you never knew what he was going to do. You never knew. And that was a real mistake, because the moment he sensed fear, then he played up on it. So it was a very difficult day. And in the end, I just had to give up on trying to get his approval on the manuscript and flew back home to Tasmania to take the manuscript to the next stage.
In all honesty, did you hate him by then?
I think hate's a little strong. I mean, I was frustrated by him and I was disturbed by him. I was just really grateful to get away from him. He was too... He was sinister. I was frightened that I wouldn't be able to hold out against him. You know, like every day was this battle of wits where I was trying to draw him into a book, but he was trying to draw me into his vision of the world. And I didn't know how many more days I could succeed before he found some weakness in me, because he was always probing, trying to find a weakness in you. So he was exhausting to be with. On that last day, he said, I mean, he was so strange. He said, what do you think will happen to the book if I'm found dead? I said, I think it'll be a bestseller, John. And he laughed. He took enormous pleasure in that. And then, of course, the next day, Maida's father rang us up and said there'd been a news item on the radio. Friedrich had been found dead on a hill outside his property at Sale, shot through the head.
Did you feel free of him then?
I'd have to say I felt free of him, yes. Yeah, and I was relieved.
Were you free of him, though?
Yes, I was, yeah.
You weren't haunted by him?
I think I was haunted in a way, and over the years, as the world became more and more his world and less the world that I thought it would become when I was a young man, I began to think he knew more about the future than I ever had. And I tried to understand why that was so, why the world had gone the way it had, and why the hopes I'd had for it hadn't been realised.
Being a ghostwriter for him means you have to hear his voice and you have to internalise his voice, the rhythm and the cadence of his speech, his thought, the way he constructs sentences. Is there a danger in that when you're ghostwriting someone like him?
I didn't feel that, no. I felt it was more that he would find a weakness in me and possess me. But what it did do was in those 6 weeks I became a novelist. I learnt to go far further with what is a bad book. But I learnt to go far further than I would have in 4 or 5 novels because I had to take on the voice and the character of someone who I fundamentally despised. And I realised there were aspects of him that I understood and was. And I realised a novelist or any human being's not one person but many. And that was at once deeply disturbing but also liberating for me as a writer, that you could be not what you knew, but all the things you never knew. That was his strange gift to me, I guess.
There's a moment in the novel where the con man shrieks at the ghost writer, "Don't you see, I made it up every day, just like you, like a writer." So, writers are thieves? Is it a different kind of thievery? Is it a more morally justifiable form of thievery than stealing all that money off the banks and employing hundreds of Australians in well-paid jobs for a while? How do you equate the morality of the different kinds of thievery that we're talking about here?
I think the history of literature is really a Milky Way of robbers and thieves who steal from their own lives, the lives of others, from laughter and tears heard behind closed doors, tales overheard in bars. They steal from dreams and nightmares and clouds in the sky. But what they create with all that is a new light. And that new light is none of the things they've stolen. And I think you can have story as lies and they poison our world. Or you can have stories as fiction and they can be transcendental and liberating because they do contain truths that we need. And I think we go to novels fundamentally to remind us that we're not alone in all our strangeness and mystery. And that's the power of novels for me. So I think novels don't have a morality. They exist beyond morality. But I don't think they're wicked in the way the pernicious use of lies is wicked.
At the time he was caught, in 1989, I remember it extremely well because I was part of a filthy comedy group. And the very second episode of the big gig that we did, we just, because he was in the news that week, we wrote a song on the fly called Free Johnny Friedrich. And what we thought we were doing was taking the life the story of a kind of a really a shonky, low-grade criminal and elevating him to the status of Nelson Mandela. And and we had a kind of chorus at the end that was sort of like, you know, free Jonathan Friedrich, what's he done? Nothing. And we were presenting him as a kind of a moral genius. How far off were we, Richard, do you think?
Well, I think you were closer to the mark than I was. I remember the video, it's very funny. And And the strange thing is, a lot of people actually believed he had been victimised, that he did do good things. There's a mythology about him which has continued to grow. I mean, he's become a little bit like Elvis. There are actually sightings of him now, you know, coming out of Bunnings in West Australia and things like this. And people believe he was, as he tried to create the mythos about himself, that he was murdered, that he didn't kill himself, and on and on and on. And people did want to see him as some symbol. But a symbol of what? I think he was a symbol of the darkness to come. I think he was a symbol of a world where the truth's constantly denied by lies. And he's a symbol of a world that in which the more implausible the lie, the more people want to believe. And that is the terrible thing I saw with him, is the desire of so many people to believe in something that they trade their freedom for. And whether it's a young kid watching jihad videos, or whether it's a politician signing up to the nonsense of imprisoning innocent people on Nauru, we seem willing to trade fundamental freedoms for terrible lies, and that there's something deeply human about that. It's not just the liar, but our desire to be deceived.
We live in a time where the President of the United States lies, contradicts himself with another lie, and then there's a third lie that contradicts those previous two. And he does so quite unabashedly, then denies he ever lied in the first place, or maybe he was lying, but then now he's telling you the truth. The point of that is that you must accept that. It's an exertion of power over you. Like, this is the truth because I say it is, and what are you going to do about it? Is that how you see this, Richard? This assertion of lies as an act of power?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's saying that you do not have the power to name your own world. And really, if you look at the novel arises at the same time as the Bible arises in the vernacular. And the first great battle of democracy was for people to be able to read the Bible in their own languages, because the great temporal power at the time, the church, wanted to say what God's word was, and you were not allowed to read it. The priest would tell you what God's word was. And it is the same battle today, that we have to fight for the power to name what our reality is, whether it's 28 degrees Celsius today, or whether that's a fabrication. So it is a battle about power. But I think it's also about whether, in that battle, we have to choose every day whether we wish to be free or whether we are willing to trade our freedom away. And if we have the courage to act as free people, to name what our truths are, then I think the world can go to a better place.
Freedom's a very important theme in this book, and I'd like you to read a part just towards the end of the novel where you talk about this very thing.
When Ray and I were young, we'd often walked and sometimes run up remote tracks to the mountaintop. Run. It was inconceivable now. The joy, the wonder of it all. The beauty that was our gaze. Everything we saw sparkled in its glory, the loveliness of it, the sweetness of it. We could not believe that such beauty was ours. We had nothing, and we had this. It was beyond explanation. We did not know that the beauty was us. We had made a philosophy out of our world as we had experienced it. The beaches, the sea, the rainforests, the wild rivers and the mountain that was our path to the sky that seemed to draw out of the rock its monumental uncaring, and the stones that brought down from the sky the tender indifference of its brilliant light. And in our wild world we found we were not, as we had been led to believe, passive slaves of destiny defined by our history as forever less. No. We discovered that we were free to choose with every step and every decision, and all hope was ours. All hope was within us for so long as we never forgot. Why had we forgotten? What had happened? Why did we trade our freedom? Were we dizzy with it? Were we lost with it? Were we unequal to it? Were we frightened of it? I don't know. At 20, we had decided to live. And later? Later, we chose differently. All we could do was run hard and laugh and run harder and harder over the rocks, up those boulders of the zigzag track as it grew steeper, wilder, more forbidding, in heat, in snow, running, panting, barking, burning, rising and running and never stopping running. The wildness we felt all around us was overwhelming. Beyond the mountain peak, there lay a land that extended all the way to the islands west and southwest, without the interruption of road or settlement, and it was possible to walk for 10 days and meet no one and see nothing other than that world until you finally reached a wild sea. We ran and we ran and we were somehow nothing, and yet of everything. It was incomprehensible. It was incommunicable. You could run it and laugh it, but you could not describe it. Words were and are inadequate to what we felt, all that we knew, all that I have lost. Words were part of it, but they were also cages in search of a bird. And we were the birds, flying quicker, harder, higher. Thank you.
To me, this seems like a novel where you have confronted some of the worst, your worst fears. Loss of personal honour, loss of family, disappearance of talents and disappearance of freedom. Is that what you're doing there? And was it hard to write about this without flinching a little?
Well, I feel that's the compact we all made over the last 30 years. We traded something and we lost something, and now we're gripped by these pandemics of loneliness and sadness, of emptiness, and we feel something fundamental being corroded out in our society, but we don't know what it is. And so the writer character makes us Faustian deal, but he's unaware of it. He thinks he's honouring his talent, whereas he finally comes to see that he's losing his world. But I feel perhaps that's been the fate of us all. But I should say I'm not pessimistic. I feel optimistic about the future. The world is better now than when I was a child. The position of women is far better, the position of children. There's an understanding that the environment is finite and that we must act to preserve it. The position of minorities is infinitely better, and so on and so on. So I feel so much has improved, and that is our trajectory. I have had dark nights of the soul, but a year ago I went to refugee camps with my good friend Ben Quilty in Lebanon and Greece and the Balkan countries, and every one of those people I met, even those who'd lost children in that fatal sea between Turkey and Europe, they hadn't lost hope. And Camus wrote, "In the depths of winter, I discovered within myself an invincible summer." And that's what I feel about the world too.
There's no better way to end this conversation than on that note, I think. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Richard Flanagan. That conversation with Richard Flanagan was recorded at the Brisbane Powerhouse. Great many thanks to the Powerhouse and Jane O'Hara and to Steve Fieldhouse for the recording. Richard Flanagan's book is called First Person. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.